This is a Human Rights Law Centre podcast. On 11 August 2015 in Melbourne, we hosted an event entitled Manus Island, Inside Australia's Pacific Non-Solution. The two speakers for the event were the Centre's own Daniel Webb, our Director of Legal Advocacy, and Elaine Pearson, the Australian Director of Human Rights Watch. The moderator for the event was Michelle Bennett, host of Triple R's Spoke program. Michelle began the event by asking our speakers just how easy or hard it is to gain access to Manus Island in PNG.
Anyone can go to Manus Island. You can just book a ticket. It's expensive to go there from Port Moresby. It costs about $600, I think, return. But you know, anyone can jump on a flight and go. The difficult thing is getting access to the centres. So I was actually in Port Moresby anyway, doing some other work on domestic violence issues, and basically for a week harangued PNG immigration pretty much on a daily basis, requesting access. So there's a form you can fill out online. You're meant to fax it somewhere. Of course, the fax machine doesn't work. It bounces back if you, you know, try and send it to the email address. So we, you know, hand-delivered it in person, and then on a regular basis just, you know, kept calling them and basically asking if we could visit the centre. So in the end, by the end of the week, they said, OK, you can visit the transit centre, which is where there are 40 refugees, but you can't actually get access to the main detention centre where there's about 850 men. So we decided, you know, we decided pretty much on that basis anyway that we were going to go, because the men in the transit centre are able to have freedom of movement. They can come and go from the village, particularly during the daytime. So we felt like it would be a good opportunity to get there on the ground. And it, precisely because I think, you know, there are so few opportunities to actually see what life is like on Manus. And the government here, you know, likes to portray it as this hell on earth. Meanwhile, you know, when you get the flight up there, you pull the magazine out from Air New Guinea and it has a cover story on Manus, and it says, Manus, one of the most beautiful places on earth. So, I mean, the reality is somewhere very much in between. I mean, it's a tropical island. It's actually quite beautiful, extremely underdeveloped. There's a lot of construction going on, you know, very poor roads. But, you know, we found people there, you know, very friendly, very welcoming. So it's, yeah, it's an interesting place.
And was this your first trip there, Elaine?
It was. It was my first time. Daniel's been there once before.
And Daniel, can you talk about what took you there? Was it the fact that Elaine was there and it felt like a good time to go? Not that I'm suggesting anything.
It had more to do with the 1,000 asylum seekers. I mean, it was a good opportunity to go there together. But sort of the latest chapter in the Manus saga is that there are now finally, after 2 years, no more than a few dozen men who've been found to be refugees and moved out of this detention centre. And we knew that they had some freedom of movement during the day. We knew they could leave this transit centre from 6 in the morning to 6 at night. So we knew whilst the PNG and Australian governments could lock us out of the detention centre, they'd find it much harder to restrict our access to these men. So we thought it was a great opportunity to get there, to speak with, at the very least, these men, hear what they had to say about their circumstances now and about the way they'd been treated over the last 2 years, and in so doing, sort of shine a light on the darkest corner of Australia's immigration detention network.
So the title of tonight's event is Inside Australia's Pacific Non-Solution, and what you're talking about there is what I suggest you consider a non-solution, being the Regional Resettlement Agreement. As you said, it was signed 2 years ago. What were your first impressions of this policy?
We at the Human Rights Law Centre had a media release out about 45 minutes after the arrangement was announced, which warned that the Regional Resettlement Arrangement carried inherent human rights risks, that Australia had never been able to implement offshore detention and processing in a way that didn't cause tremendous harm to the people who were subject to it, and tremendous harm to individuals was what inevitably would flow from the Manus arrangements. And I think everything we've seen since has vindicated those deep fears we had immediately.
And Elaine, from a Human Rights Watch perspective?
Well, I think, 2 years ago when that agreement was signed, Rudd said, you know, the unique thing about this agreement is that people will be resettled in the region, including in Papua New Guinea. And 2 years later, not a single person has been resettled. So, you know, the unique thing about that agreement has never been fulfilled. And I think, I mean, this was clearly a political agreement between O'Neill and Rudd. It was something that was, you know, necessary in order for, you know, Rudd supposedly going into an election. It was pandering to a domestic political constituency. But it was not an agreement that was really well thought out in terms of policy terms, in terms of trying to protect the rights of people who were coming on the boats. And I think that's been the whole problem, is that all of this talk about a regional solution really should have involved actually the countries that people were transiting through, countries like Indonesia, Malaysia, Thailand, rather than simply, you know, thrusting Australia's international obligations onto countries that are really ill-equipped and not safe, you know, even for minorities and people who are vulnerable in their own population, let alone foreigners coming from far-off lands.
Well, let's talk about those conditions, because after you hounded a fax machine that wasn't working, you were able to gain access to the transit centre. So can you talk about, there are 40 men who have been moved from the detention centre into the transit centre. Talk about those men and what their stories are.
Yeah, so we interviewed 10 or so of the 40 men, and I would say, I mean, there's a real mixture there. You have some that are highly educated. One of the men that we interviewed is an engineer. Another is a doctor from Afghanistan. You know, they're people who, for whatever reason, you know, fled their countries, fled persecution in their home countries. All of these men are refugees, so all of them have been found to have, you know, well-regarded fears of persecution. And, you know, you have others there, say, for instance, some of the ones from Burma or Bangladesh, who, you know, are less well-educated, but have also, you know, fled persecution in their home countries. They may be farmers. And so with this great disparity, I think it's quite difficult to know how they're actually going to fit into PNG culture. I mean, it may be easier for someone who's an engineer or a doctor to then find some kind of opportunity working, you know, for instance, for a construction company or a mining company in PNG. It's going to be a lot more difficult for, you know, the Muslim from Burma who has been working as a, you know, rice farmer to find opportunities. And a real disparity, I would say, also in terms of the mental health of the men that we interviewed. Some of them were clearly very depressed, very anxious. Some of them, even though they have freedom of movement to come and go from the centre, some of them are so scared, particularly because of the violence that they witnessed the night that Reza Barati was killed, that they're extremely fearful of the local PNG population, and so they don't want to go out. They don't want to leave the centre. They pretty much just stay in their rooms, smoking cigarettes, hanging out all day.
I wanted to ask about that. If you could talk through an average day in the transit centre, what do these men do?
Well, when we were there, it was Ramadan. So because of the fasting, I would say in the morning there was really not a lot going on, particularly for the men who are Muslim. A lot of them are Muslim from Afghanistan, from Burma, Iran, Iraq. They're the main countries that we interviewed people from. So the morning was pretty quiet. Throughout the day, there are various lessons and classes that they can enroll in, and these classes are provided by Transfield, the Australian contractor. But they're very basic classes. So for someone who has come from Iran and speaks very good English, to have very basic English classes where you're learning to spell the word cat or something is quite, you know, it's demeaning to people. And a lot of the skills that they're trying to teach them about life in PNG, again, are at a very basic, simplistic level. So while they may be appropriate for some people, certainly for the people who've been in there for, you know, it's coming up 2 years now, six or seven months that they've been in the transit centre, a lot of them just felt like they weren't getting any value at all out of these classes. There's the odd excursion for them to the village or to other parts of the island, but many of them complained about the boredom and the monotony of not having anything to do. So they may walk into the village, which is a 45-minute walk, then walk, you know, back to the centre. And, you know, I mean, it's an island, so there, you know, there are places to go swimming. But, you know, a lot of them don't sort of enjoy, I guess, the nice things of island life.
How happy were they to speak to you and tell you their stories?
They were not that happy initially, I would say. A number of them were actually quite They were quite upset, and some of them felt like there'd been many organisations coming through to talk to them and nothing had changed. So I felt like right at the beginning I had, you know, a number of them, and I'd reached out to them in advance and they'd said, well, what's going to be the difference when Human Rights Watch visits here? You know, how is this going to change our lives? And I just said to them up front, look, you know, probably nothing's going to change as a result of Human Rights Watch and Human Rights Law Centre writing our report. All I can say to you is that I will tell people about what I see and what is going on here, and that I will tell people, politicians and government officials, but I absolutely cannot promise you that anything will change because, you know, many people, many organisations have been reporting on this. And I think they really appreciated that Daniel and I were quite upfront about those things. And once some people started to talk, I think they actually find it quite helpful and cathartic. So, you know, we actually found then that more and more men did start to want to talk to us and did start to open up. And particularly we were there over 3-4 days. So we even found that some of the people who initially were a little bit reluctant by the second or third day were coming to us and saying, could we spend some time with you?
Daniel, are they able to access healthcare in the centre? You know, you touched on there the mental illness that we know that comes from prolonged detention. What sort of access to healthcare do they have?
When they get sick, and it's something that can be treated on the island, they get taken to the Lorengau Hospital, which is an incredibly basic facility, staffed by people who no doubt do their best in difficult circumstances. But, I mean, Manus is a remote place in a country that's still developing, and it struggles to meet the health needs of Papua New Guineans. Refugees who by definition have endured a lot in their lives are a particularly complex caseload from a medical point of view, and whilst there is access to basic medical services on the island, no, I don't think there's anything that long term can deal with the inherent complexities involved in managing the health needs of 1,000 refugees.
What responsibility does Australia and the Australian government think that it has for these people in this transit centre?
They're two very different questions. I mean, the responsibility that the Australian government thinks it has is next to none. The responsibility that it has morally is absolute. The responsibility that it has legally, I think, is joint with Papua New Guinea. And that's because, quite sensibly, the concept at the heart of responsibility under international law is control. It would defeat the purpose of international human rights law if you could just do beyond your borders things that you couldn't lawfully do within them. So states are responsible for what they do, irrespective of where they do it. Australia has a lot of control in Papua New Guinea when it comes to these asylum seeker arrangements. Every single service provider contract, health service, legal service, security service, every single one of those contracts is between Australia and the service provider. PNG is not a party to any one of those contracts. So Australia writes the contracts, it signs the checks, it pulls the strings, and that sort of practical responsibility and control equates to legal responsibility and control.
Are there Australian staff at that centre?
At the transit centre there were Australian expat guards. There weren't Australian government officials in the transit centre, which is very different from the detention centre. When I was in the detention centre a year earlier, the place was swarming with Australian Department of Immigration staff, people wearing Australian government uniforms. They were everywhere. They even had like an office inside the detention centre. I didn't see a single Papua New Guinean government representative inside the detention centre. But it was swarming with Australian government officials. So the physical presence of Australia at the transit centre was much less.
There is a memorandum of understanding between Australia and PNG that says that those that are transferred to this centre will be treated with dignity and respect and in accordance with relevant human rights standards. What are those human rights standards?
I mean, this is actually where, I guess, our investigation and the report that we put out after we got back, you know, we are concerned that they're not meeting these obligations under the MOU or under international human rights standards. So a primary one is freedom of movement. So while those who are in detention obviously have no freedom of movement, they can't leave the centre, those in the transit centre have it for Manus Island, but many of them described it as an island prison. They can't leave the centre. So even, for instance, one of the guys who has quite a lot of initiative and went ahead after he got his work permit saying that he could work in PNG, went ahead and set up some interviews in Port Moresby and booked himself a flight. He was prevented by PNG immigration from getting on that flight and from leaving the island because they said there's an absence of resettlement policy. So freedom of movement, you know, certainly is, you know, one of the very basic rights. And, you know, it has knock-on effects, I think, for, you know, a lot of the other concerns that they have in terms of their mental state, their ability to then, you know, move on, the right to work. They're not even allowed to volunteer. So, you know, a couple of them had told us, you know, they're bored on Manus Island. They want something to do just to pass the time. And even some of the local people on Manus have said things like, well, we'd be quite happy to employ them in the hotel because they speak good English, or one of them was a barber. They could see that this would be a good, you know, agreement between the hotel and, you know, they were willing to offer up a space. But even those sort of little things, PNG immigration has said the absence of a resettlement policy by the government has meant that, you know, any of those rights are not going to be protected.
So is that resettlement policy, is that coming? Are we waiting for that?
Two draft resettlement policies have been prepared in PNG. They've both been knocked back by PNG Cabinet. We don't really know why. There's a third draft policy, and PNG Immigration explained to me that the gist of that third draft was the principle of self-sufficiency. So it was this document that sort of was light on practical detail, light on where they're going to send people, how they're going to keep them safe, how they're going to find them work, but it just emphasised this principle of self-sufficiency. You've got to be able to look after yourself, which was, I mean, it was quite a worrying thing to hear, because 2 years ago, the Prime Ministers of both Australia and PNG stood there side by side and said, we've got a resettlement arrangement. 2 years later, turns out all they've actually got is a draft document yet to be submitted to the government that talks about self-sufficiency.
With that self-sufficiency, you sort of touched on this, Elaine, but is there a right to work?
When we got there, only one of the 40 refugees had a PNG identity document, which included a work permit. And we saw it and it clearly said, you know, it was issued back in January and it said, you know, this work permit's valid for a year, can work anywhere in PNG. After we left, and I do think that this was as a result of our visit, they issued seven more of those documents. So now eight refugees have them. But they're completely worthless because they can't actually activate it. They can't move. They can't work. So I think, I mean, the PNG government is trying to sort of look like it's doing the right things. I think they're saying to Australia, look, you know, we're issuing these documents, just give us a bit more time and we'll implement them. But in reality, you know, it's kind of useless. And I think that's what also, you know, upsets the refugees, because they think, oh, well, here we are, we have this opportunity, you know, we can move on with our lives, we've been given these documents, and then they realise, actually, we're just being used by the government. And that's what, you know, one of them said to me, is I just feel like I've been completely sort of exploited and used.
What about the community in PNG? You mentioned there that some of them have said that they would be very happy to employ people. How easy would that integration be? And for these refugees in the sort of cultural aspects of PNG, how easy could that integration be?
I think it's going to be extremely difficult for them. So the way that the agreement is set up is there is no agreement for people to remain on Manus. The idea is that, you know, supposedly they will be moved to Port Moresby, I think Goroka, Lae, some of the other provincial sort of cities. But, you know, I do sort of foresee quite a lot of problems in terms of language, racism. They're learning Tok Pidgin, which is the PNG language, but, you know, it's at a very, again, it's at a very sort of basic level. Some of the refugees do not speak very good English. And then, you know, I think, you know, there are, on Manus, there has been sort of this mix of people who've been actually quite welcoming and hospitable to refugees. And indeed, you know, one of the refugees that actually had trouble at the transit centre from some others, some other detainees there, actually sought sanctuary with the PNG family. So I think there's a danger of sort of, casting PNG is this, you know, awfully violent, terrible place where everyone is going to be, you know, out to get these refugees. It's not like that. It's a lot more mixed. It's a lot more complicated. And I think there are people there that can see that they can really sort of add value in terms of businesses and lifestyle. But I really worry that the way that the PNG government is selling this is really as a skilled migrant program, in the same way that they, you know, accept expats to come and work in PNG for certain companies, rather than seeing it as, you know, people who have fled pretty awful conditions and really need protection and assistance.
Does what happens in the media in Australia around asylum seekers and the rhetoric from our government, does that feed into how the community feels about asylum seekers in PNG? Did you get that impression?
Yeah, we actually, I had a government official in PNG, and I won't say who, say, oh, look, it's going to take time for us to get the PNG community ready to resettle refugees because we've got to undo all of that damage that your media has done in vilifying these people. So it turns out they, you know, read certain newspapers over there as well. But, I mean, I do want to sort of tell one story of a guy that I met there that made me realise the key impediment to resettling people in PNG is not a want of generosity and compassion in the hearts and minds of Papua New Guineans. It's that PNG is a tough place for many other reasons. And this is a guy who'd been in detention for 2 years. He had received his preliminary refugee status, and he was told that all that had to happen for him to be released from detention was for him to get his second refugee status, the personal tick of approval from the PNG minister. And whilst in detention, he was told, you know, how would you like to go to Port Moresby and meet the minister? And he was very excited. He said, I'm very happy, I'll go to Port Moresby and I'll meet the minister and he'll give me my second positive. So they took him to Port Moresby. They put him up at a nice hotel, fed him pizza, took him shopping. He swam in the pool. Then the next day he went to meet with the minister and they said, oh, just while we're waiting, can you pose for a photo? And he poses for a photo, holding a sign saying, thank you for helping us. And, you know, unfortunately the minister was then unavailable and they took him back to Manus, but they gave him his refugee status. Then a few weeks later at the transit centre, he hears this bang, bang, bang on the door, and it's the other refugees who are really angry at him because there he is in the newspaper, the PNG newspaper, holding a sign, wearing a big smile, saying, thank you for helping us. So he's part of this advertising campaign that suggests these men are grateful for the fact that they've been detained for 2 years. And so he fled the detention centre and he hid and he was wandering down the road crying at 1 a.m. in the middle of the night, and a local family saw him and they took him in and he lived with them for 4 days. And these were people in a fishing village on Manus. They couldn't possibly have understood what he'd fled from. They couldn't have possibly understood the political, you know, context in Australia or anything like that. They just saw a man in need and they helped him. And the sort of message I got from that was that, you know, there are a lot of fundamentally decent and compassionate people in PNG that will do what they can to help refugees, but PNG is a difficult place to resettle refugees because it's got its hands full with its own domestic challenges. And it's certainly much less well-equipped to resettle 1,000 refugees than Australia is.
You both expressed concern after speaking to these men that there had been pressure placed on them to either return home as well. Who's applying that pressure?
I mean, the pressure, the government talks about voluntary returns from PNG, but I think that concept of voluntariness is a bit of a misnomer. Because you've got people who are sort of left languishing in detention for a few years. The conditions have been described by the UN Refugee Agency as inhumane, and I've seen them myself, and I think that that's a fairly accurate assessment. And they don't know how long they're going to be in detention for, when they're ever going to be released, and where they're going to be released to. So some of them give up. They can't take it anymore. They go home. But that decision, you know, when you're between a rock and a hard place and you choose the rock, it's sort of hardly a voluntary choice. The UN described that combination of mandatory and indefinite detention and harsh physical conditions and uncertainty as creating a return-orientated environment, an environment that pushes people home. And I think that's fairly accurate.
The refugees told us that any time that they complained about anything when they were in detention or in the transit centre, the response from PNG immigration, from Australian officials, from Transfield or Wilson was always, if you don't like it, just go home. And it's this kind of attitude and response, I think, which also just makes them feel like, well, you know, we don't have a choice. We are the genuine refugees who can't go back. And this is, you know, the crazy thing about Australia's policy is that those, you know, economic migrants who had a choice and who could return to those countries, they've taken the packages offered by the International Organization for Migration. They've taken the money to go back home and start a business. But what you're left with is actually the people from countries like Syria and Iraq and Iran who really have no other choice. And, I mean, they're the ones who are still bearing the brunt of these policies, unable to work, unable to move on with their lives.
I want to talk about conditions in the detention centre. You just mentioned what the UN thinks of them. Daniel, you've been to the centre before. You didn't go on this trip. But, Elaine, you spoke to some people via phone from the detention centre. What do we know of conditions there now?
I mean, the conditions in detention are much worse than in the transit centre. I mean, the transit centre was, you know, the facilities are quite nice and new. It's not crowded. Whereas the detention centre, it's on a naval base. It's very difficult to get to. Daniel and I actually did manage to sort of drive past it. And you can see it's all these very sort of small, you know, like mining similar accommodation, all grouped together. I mean, I heard things like, you know, the rations are very small. So, for instance, a guy from Syria told me how they got one piece of soap to last them for 2 weeks and that people would actually wash themselves with sand because they had nothing to clean themselves with. They talk about water shortages, that often the showers don't even work, the toilets don't work, that they're disgusting, inadequate food, they're given food that's expired, and then, you know, also, you know, mistreatment from guards. So this sort of paints, I guess, a picture of what, you know, life in the detention centres like.
And Daniel, does that sort of gel with what you saw when you did visit the centre?
Yeah, the physical conditions were horrible. I mean, I've said this before, but before I went there, I'd read everything that had been written about conditions inside that centre. I'd read Amnesty International's report, I'd read the two United Nations Refugee Agency's reports, but nothing can prepare you to see those conditions firsthand. I mean, I'll never forget walking through a room not much bigger than this that had 120 bunk beds in it. So 240 men were detained in that one room, not much bigger than this. And you're not talking about detention for a few weeks. You're talking about detention for 2 years with no end in sight. It was shocking. And I think sort of driving past by stealth as we did this time around and peering out the window, you could see you know, that the fence had changed, but all the signs are that everything that's happening behind that fence remains the same, and that's that you've got this huge number of people languishing there.
How much does Australia pay to run that centre?
About $600 million a year over the last 2 years has been the average, and the total cost of offshore detention is over $1 billion a year, which, you know, by way of comparison, is five times the United Nations Refugee Agency's budget for all of Southeast Asia. So Australia spends over $1 billion locking up about 1,700 people on two islands, and that's five times more than the UN does, than the UN has, to try and process and resettle these people before they get on boats in the first place.
Does the government pay extra for the transit centre? Is that considered quite separate to the detention centre?
Yeah, under the MOU that you referred to previously, Australia pays all costs necessary and incidental to the arrangements. So that covers everything to do with detention, everything to do with resettlement, and it also covers, as we found out last year after the court case that we were involved in on Manus was appealed, it extends to the Australian government paying the Papua New Guinean government's legal fees in court cases.
There has been a case in the Australian High Court, Daniel, testing the power of the government to run and fund offshore detention. Can you explain the details of this case and where it stands now?
So, we know that the Australian government has the power to detain asylum seekers in Australia. We know that it has the power to deport asylum seekers from Australia. The question at the heart of this case is whether it then has the power to detain those people in the territories of other nations. We initially argued that the Australian government could only do those things, could only lock people up anywhere, and could only spend our money, public money, when there was clear legislative authority, when the Parliament had authorised that detention and that expenditure. And believe it or not, there was no law that gave the government the power to do what it was doing, and we knew that. So they passed one, and they passed one with great haste. And what was amazing about that law, apart from the fact that it purports to authorise detention in the territories of other countries, is that it applies retrospectively to authorise 3 years' worth of detention of thousands of people and the expenditure of billions of dollars for that purpose. A truly unprecedented piece of legislation. But the case remains on foot because there are serious questions about whether a law like that is supported by the Australian Constitution, whether it's a valid law.
So just to be clear with that, though, the legislation was changed halfway through this court case.
It was, and in circumstances of quite contrived urgency. The Commonwealth had known of our arguments for months, and it also knew we weren't going to get a hearing before the High Court until October at the earliest. Yet at a minute to midnight on a Thursday night, the media reported that the Prime Minister called the opposition leader and said, "We need your urgent help to close this loophole, and if you don't close it, it's all going to come crashing down." And the Labor Party, sadly, duly obliged, rubber-stamped what is an incredible piece of legislation, and it sailed through the Parliament the next day.
With such bipartisan support for something like that, where do you see this headed?
I mean, look, the great thing about constitutional arguments is you can't legislate them away. And as disappointing as it was to see the goalposts shifted mid-case, it's not the first time. We had a case last year about the extent of the government's maritime powers prior to that case being heard by the High Court. The government amended the Maritime Powers Act, and the amendments sounded a lot like our submissions to the court. There was another case before the court that argued that babies of asylum seekers, babies of boat arrivals, aren't classified as boat arrivals under Australian law. The government amended the law prior to that case being heard to say, retrospectively, children of asylum seekers who arrive by boat are treated by the law as if they arrived by boat. So there's a pattern here that when limits on its power are raised, rather than seeing whether those limits have been infringed, the government seeks to remove them. But given that the limits we now seek to raise are constitutional, it can't do that.